This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
A military coup in Sudan dissolved the country's ruling civilian-led transitional government. This not only jeopardizes Sudan's security, but it has wider implications for North Africa and prophetic implications as well. To learn about this, we'll turn to Brent.
Yeah, this is it's not necessarily a shocking coup that it took place, but it really is taking away a lot of the hopes of the Sudanese people, because they had the rule of Omar al-Bashir for about 30 years, really a dictator that ruled Sudan, and there was a massive uprising against him in 2019, and he was removed from power. And then you had this transitional government that was meant to last for about 3 years before you would have elections. And yet this transitional government is what fell apart just this week on October 25th. And it was a military coup, but it was kind of like an inside job, because the guy that led the, obviously it always kind of is with a military coup. However, the man Abdel Fattah al-Burhan is his name. He was the strongest leader inside this transitional government, apart from perhaps the prime minister. And for the first year or so of the transitional, year and a half of this transitional government, there was the military side of the transitional government that held the most seats in kind of this governing coalition between the military and civilian powers. And in November, that was due to change. And so the military would no longer have the strongest hand inside this transitional government. And so they decided, before the civilians have the most power, we're going to bring it down. And so al-Burhan was part of the government, but he brought it down. He put the prime minister under house arrest. He's since been released. We don't really know how this is going to play out going forward. The reaction on the street has probably surprised, I would think, the military, in that there has been extreme popular support against the military coup. As you would expect among the people, they believe democracy is coming to their country for the first time in a long time. And so they're going to be rising up against this military coup. However, it looks like this military coup is getting some support from some regional powers. The United States, for its part, really did condemn the coup. France, the European Union, the United Nations, others had their ambassadors removed from Sudan this week because the military was very upset with the comments that those governments had made, or those groups had made, against the coup. So it's hard to, I guess, see what's going to play out right now. But this is what we do see is a massive we're entering into a massive crisis and destabilization of Sudan because this country is not experienced, let's say, at transitions towards democracy. Mm. And that's what we're seeing right now. The military was fearful that the transition to democracy would happen too fast, and so they're stepping in to stop that from happening.
So let's just talk about the composition of the Sudanese people and what sort of forces there are within the country that are at play here and could impact the country's future. What was it that, say, the military was concerned about? What might a democratization of the country result in?
Yeah, this is always the big fear when you have a heavily Muslim country, which is obviously Sudan is. South Sudan might be a little bit different. However, the fear is that if you have a democratic rule in a heavily Muslim country, that you are going to have an influx of Islamists into the government, meaning that they would like to rule by more of Islamic rule, Islamic law. And many are seeing this coup as an attempt by the military to kind of stave off that. There might be some type of power sharing deal that has worked out. There were several members of the civilian side of the transitional government that the military did not want to have power, specific members. There was also the worry that the civilians would get in control and then they would prosecute members of the military for war crimes, which what happened in Sudan a few years ago. So their personal heads might be on the chopping block in the future. And they didn't want that. And of course, you do have the long-standing tradition in Sudan of actually giving safe haven to Islamists. That's what Bashir did. And so the Muslim Brotherhood is very active inside Sudan. And so I think the way to see this right now, and I'm not against people electing their leaders, however, I think the way to look at this right now, given that this leader that just took power is allied with Egypt, is allied with the Saudi Arabians, is allied with the UAE, these powers that, though they rule over Muslim countries, they understand the dangers of democracy or quick transition to democracy inside their country, because the pragmatist Muslim might be out and the Islamist Muslim power might be in, which means bordering on, you know, the Sharia law, but also the demand of Islam to extend beyond their borders with holy war as well. And so that's what Sisi has kind of put a stop to, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi in Egypt, by mm-hmm. clamping down on the Muslim Brotherhood. And now Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, now in Sudan, just to the south of Egypt, looks to be attempting to do the same thing. However, there is a big worry that the street inside Sudan is not going to back the military coup like they did for Sisi in Egypt. The people actually backed Sisi's military coup against Mohamed Morsi. They did, because Morsi was turning the country into an Islamic state mm-hmm. too fast for even the population themselves. And commentators are coming out saying now that, yes, we might have military rule and it might kind of, let's say, make sure the Islamists get under control. However, the street in Sudan is far more volatile, especially considering what's happening to the south of Sudan, where a massive civil war is engulfing Ethiopia, sending refugees over into Sudan. Again, just another factor to add into an area where it's just difficult to let's say, difficult to forecast the end result if we didn't have the Bible.
Right. Well, let's get into that. And if maybe you could even talk a little bit about how Sudan's role within the region factors in, and then what the Bible says about what we can expect.
Yeah, so Sudan, obviously to the north of Sudan is Egypt, to the south, the biggest nation, the most populous nation would be Ethiopia. And the Bible talks about how this whole territory from Ethiopia, including Egypt, and even going across into Libya, which is really, if you look at biblical terminology, pushing over to Algeria even. The Bible talks about this area getting in control by the king of the south, which, and this is mentioned in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40 to 45. And we talk mostly about Iran and how, and radical Islam being the head of the king of the south. But maybe perhaps we don't focus much on that. The main, let's say, the territory that this king of the south is going to control is actually this whole eastern side of the Red Sea passageway, from Djibouti, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Sudan being the very center, I'd say, nation connecting Ethiopia to Egypt, and then going into the southern Mediterranean region. Biblical prophecy says that the Islamists are going to gain control in this area. And so when we see absolutely these huge crises taking place in Ethiopia, and then we see a fractured Ethiopia with this war that's going on between the Tigrayans in northern Ethiopia and the Amhara, a different tribe in the south, in the center. And then you see Sudan blow up in a period of absolute destabilization. Then you know this prophecy is getting ready, or some big changes are getting ready to take place in this region. Now, if you do control the complete Red Sea passageway. This makes your control over trade through this crucial gateway or this crucial transit point for maritime trade, oil trade from Europe, Asia to Europe for other trade. You're holding basically all the trade through there at ransom of potentially Islamist characters. Right now, we have a danger in the southern Red Sea, based because you have Iranian-backed Houthis, which control the southern gateway of the Red Sea. And they use that to, they use their home base in Yemen to send exploding boats towards vessels going through there to lay, you don't hear about this, but lay naval mines at the Bab el-Mandab at the southern entrance to the Red Sea. This happens all the time, actually. But what about if you have an Islamist power that controls the entire eastern seaboard of the Red Sea, including the Suez Canal, including the Bab el-Mandab from the Ethiopian side? That's a really big danger for Europe in particular. And even commentators are coming out and saying about what's happening in Sudan. This is just another weight or another worry on Europe's southern border, that there would be a massive immigration of migrants again coming up through the Sahel, coming up through the southern Sahara, across to Libya and Egypt, and coming over into southern Europe. And so there's a lot of worried people that destabilization, the Horn of Africa, can affect trade. Destabilization in North Africa and Northeast Africa can affect massive migration routes, or massive migration, into southern Europe. And so you can bet Europe is going to be looking at this as well, worried what might happen.
Where would you send people for a better understanding of these prophecies you're talking about?
The prophetic understanding, I think, is best described in Mr. Fleury's book, Libya and Ethiopia in Prophecy. Again, we are trying to look at Sudan and forecast the future. No one can do that right now. No one can look at Ethiopia and see what a mess it's in and forecast the future. And how, apart from if we didn't have the Bible, we know what the Bible says the end result is going to be. And so who maximizes these periods of destabilization? It's mainly radical Islam can mobilize forces the best.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Brent. Russia's military has undergone remarkable advancement in recent years under Vladimir Putin, and America's withdrawal from Afghanistan underscores the threat Russia poses to the West. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, a very interesting report was published by the 1945 Defense publication on Wednesday, and it examines just kind of the trajectory of the Russian military over the last few decades. It points out that toward the end of the Cold War, the Russians were focusing heavily on nuclear weapons and the ability to use those to take an enemy out of a fight very quickly. That was the big focus, especially in the 70s and 80s, and that meant that conventional forces during that time were largely neglected. And that remained the case during the 1990s, which was just a really chaotic decade for Russia. But then, as you said, Vladimir Putin came into power there in 2000, and he began righting the ship. And he implemented a system of major reforms for the Russian military, which was designed to both modernize it and to better integrate the nuclear and conventional forces. So it was a really ambitious undertaking, especially considering the state of disrepair that the conventional forces had fallen into. But this new 1945 report shows the remarkable progress that Putin has made in this campaign. It discusses thousands of new and upgraded weapon systems that Russia's ground forces have received in recent years. And then it focuses on how much emphasis is being given to the motorized rifle troops and the tank troops. It also emphasizes the immense value to Russia of all those military exercises that we speak about on Trumpet Hour so often, these large-scale drills that put weaponry and soldiers to the test. And the analysts at 1945 say that this is all happening because Putin wants to be sure that the Russian army can fight NATO in a war. So NATO, we know, is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It does include the U.S. and Canada, but the overwhelming majority of its members are European nations. Almost all of Europe is part of NATO, more than 25 European countries. And this 1945 report says being able to fight NATO is at the heart of Putin's modernization programs. So this is just a dramatic modernization that's happening with Russia's military, and so much of it is happening in a way that's clearly intended to enable Russia to fight Europe.
So how much does America's withdrawal from Afghanistan intensify this this trend that you're talking about?
I think it factors in considerably. You know, that that withdrawal was just terribly chaotic, and it has raised all kinds of questions from America's allies about the U.S.'s commitment to them and about America's competency even and its will to use its power. It really represented a collapse in American leadership. And there is evidence that this has many Europeans thinking that they need to prepare to face rivals, including Russia, without the U.S. The European Commission president recently said, "You can have the most advanced forces in the world, but if you're never prepared to use them, of what use are they?" And then the EU's foreign affairs representative followed that up recently saying, quote, "The need for more European defense has never been as much evident." So, you know, more and more European leaders see that the U.S. can't be counted on. Afghanistan made that just terrifyingly clear, I think. And that realization would make them that much more alarmed by this modernization of Russia's military, which seems to be placing Europe in Putin's crosshairs.
This really does comport with what Gerald Flurry, our editor-in-chief, has been saying for some time about Europe's response to the threat from Russia.
Yes, yes, it does. You know, several European nations, especially in Eastern Europe, they've endured all kinds of just extreme brutality from Russian soldiers in the past. And now many people in those countries are understandably alarmed by Russia's rise and by its increasing aggression with invading parts of Europe and with its these modernization efforts that are intended to be able to fight Europe. And Mr. Flurry has discussed several times just how fearful this is making Europe. One of those was in an article that he wrote shortly after Russia had annexed Crimea from Ukraine. At that time, he wrote, "The fear you see in Europe because of events in Crimea is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way and in precise accordance with the Bible's description of a European empire. Europe's new fear of Russia is going to play a major role in hastening the fulfillment of that prophecy." So, you know, Europeans, we should understand that many of their leaders and policymakers really take note when they see Russia building up its military, especially in a way that's clearly focusing on being able to go to war against Europe. It's understandably alarming to many Europeans. And as Mr. Flurry said there, that will play a big role in their decision to unify Europe.
What would you say is the best single source for better understanding what Gerald Flurry has been saying on this point?
I would say, the best single one, it may actually be this article that I just quoted from. It's quite a lengthy analysis that he wrote there in 2014. It's called "The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe." And it really shows just so many of the prophecies about Russia's rise, but even specifically how Europe is responding to that and how alarming that response will be.
All right, we will link to that in the show notes for today's program. Thank you very much for that. Jeremiah, how ready is Europe to counter the rising military might of Russia and the rest of Asia? A story from last week showed there certainly are German soldiers who are ready to go to war, and it also pointed to a specific biblical prophecy. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, I do think this is an interesting story because it does tie into several different aspects of things that we're watching. But two retired German soldiers were arrested just over a week ago for the crime of allegedly seeking to form a mercenary group to fight on behalf of Saudi Arabia in Yemen. Spiegel wrote, "What sounds like a wild tale told by former soldiers now actually seems to have been largely confirmed." So there were these two ex-soldiers. They planned to recruit another 100 to 150 former soldiers and former policemen. And they're said to work through right-wing, potentially even far-right kind of channels. We've talked about some of the far-right problems Germany has had in their military. I guess they were reaching out to some of those elements in the ex-military. And they plan to go help out Saudi Arabia and make a lot of money in the process. So the federal prosecutor's office said that this unit that they would command would inevitably have to carry out acts of killing, and that civilians would also be killed and injured in conjunction with the combat operations. Now, they seem to have failed to get in touch with the Saudi Arabian government so thus far, or get Saudi Arabia to agree to pay them or anything like that. But still kind of a crazy thing to be going on with some people trying to put together a bit of a private army to go fight in Yemen.
So first of all, what do you think this tells you about these German soldiers, about Germany's let's say war making capability? Is there any broader lessons you can take on that front?
Yeah, I think there's a lot. I think one of the things that makes this especially interesting is Germany does have quite the post-war history with secret armies. I mean, there were a couple of pretty significantly sized private secret armies after 1945, before Germany had their official army, where you had ex-soldiers that served in the Wehrmacht, in the German army during World War II, that saw Russia next door and quietly got pretty significant numbers of people together, and the government colluded with them and made sure that weapons that were there for the police in emergencies, that these armed for these kind of private armies knew where those weapons were, could access them, this kind of thing, so that they could activate in case of an emergency. So it's kind of interesting to see this same thing going on. I think it also shows a certain frustration probably within the German army that the German military isn't more active, that they're not doing more to support some of these people. I don't know how much these people were in there for just to make money versus how much they're in there in, you know, they see a problem exactly like Brent. I mean, we're just across the narrow strait from where Brent was kind of talking about, and he really emphasized how much this area of the world affects Europe. You know, did these people see that? Did they, were they kind of proud of their abilities that they developed within the German army and disappointed they weren't able to put it to more use? I think certainly you can see it reflecting an amount of frustration within the German army, and maybe a closeness to Saudi Arabia too. I think that's another, like I said, this touches off on a whole variety of things that we're watching. We've been watching the relationship between Germany and Saudi Arabia very closely, and you do have the German army does a lot to train Gulf soldiers and Saudi soldiers, and there are training centers that have been set up, and there's there's arms trade relationships as well. So could this be indicative of a kind of a closer relationship between the German military and Saudi Arabia, and all of those different things that we've touched on are all prophetically significant.
Well, why don't you talk about that prophecy, the link between Germany and Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, I think this is definitely the most direct prophetic connection in terms of this story, this news story. But you know, Brent talked about how Europe is going to have to get more involved in the Middle East, and how some of these problems are really just begging for European involvement. America, I think, has made very clear they're not going to do it. And the Bible makes this very clear. Some of the key prophecies that we're watching, and that, again, Brent alluded to, we've got Daniel chapter 11 and this clash that's going to come between a European king of the north and a Muslim king of the south. But the prophecies around there make clear that Germany and Europe doesn't do this alone. They have their own allies within the Middle East that they work with, which makes sense as they get drawn into this region. They're combating some enemies and they're drawing closer to others. Psalm 83 is one of the most specific prophecies that gets in and names some of these allies that Germany is working with. It's a prophecy that details an alliance between Asher, which is Germany and Bible prophecy, and a host of other nations. And we've not seen this alliance anywhere before in history. It's a prophecy from modern times. And one of the key members of that alliance, it says, are the Ishmaelites, which I don't think you even need to have a great understanding of Bible prophecy to know that Ishmael is referring to the Arabs, and you know, the biggest Arab country is Saudi Arabia. So you've got this prophecy that Germany would have a close relationship to Saudi Arabia, would fight alongside Saudi Arabia. And so I think this story could well be indicative of closening ties between the German military establishment and the Saudi military. So definitely something to watch. And then just when you've got these kind of far right private armies, I think that I'll just put in a plug for an article I wrote as well a little bit ago. Why does Germany have so many neo-Nazi conspiracies? Where you start to put this in context with all of these other trends that we've seen in Germany. And there's certainly a kind of a worrying far right direction within the German military that's indicative of something rising to the fore.
Well, we do have an article on the website from Josue Michels, German soldiers planned to recruit mercenaries to fight in Yemen, that we will link to in the show notes. And he goes into the prophecy that Richard was just speaking about in some detail. We thank you for bringing that to us, Richard. The Biden administration in the United States is working diligently to spend America into economic collapse. Sources say plans are in the works to propose a $500 billion deal to combat climate change. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the Biden administration's basically on the eve of getting its $2 trillion social spending plan passed. They've got still some last minute negotiations on whether some of those items will get a price cut or not. But the one item in the spending package that looks like it's definitely not going to get a reduced price cut is the climate change part. Like you said, $500 billion, $500 billion devoted to combating climate change that Biden really wants to get passed before he goes on his buddy road trip with Barack Obama to the Glasgow Climate Change Conference next week. And you start looking at the details of this package, it's mostly new grants and loans to support industrial sector decarbonization and manufacturing credits to help grow supply chains for things like solar and wind power. And there's a lot of things you could say about this $500 billion package. But probably the most imminent one right now is that this is the worst possible time for this. Blackstone is a private equity firm, one of the two biggest in the United States, together with Vanguard, practically owns the United States in many ways. And its CEO, Steven Schwarzman, was recently warning about how bad the energy crisis in the world is right now. He told this to a journalist at CNN, actually. He says, we're going to end up with a real energy shortage. And when you have a shortage, it's going to cost more, and it's probably going to cost a lot more. You're going to get very unhappy people around the world and emerging markets in particular, particularly in the developed world. When that happens, you're going to get unrest and the challenge to political systems that's utterly unnecessary. So he's warning. I mean, probably anyone of our American listeners have noticed that gas prices are really high, but energy prices are really high around the world right now, to the point where you've got very important people saying that you're going to start seeing civil unrest in a lot of nations over this. And the big reason he's saying these energy shortages are as acute as they are, in addition to the inflation and the general supply chain shortages, is that it's almost impossible or very difficult for American companies to get loans for new oil and natural gas drilling right now. The Biden administration, it's got this huge $500 billion package where it's trying to shut down the oil and gas wells and build windmills instead. And I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that the windmills, they're great at killing birds. They're not great at generating electricity. And so this global energy crisis that all these captains of industry are talking about, going to be fueling revolutions in countries around the world, is not going to be allayed by $500 billion in windmill spending. It's just going to increase inflation, worsen the energy crisis that's going on in the world right now, drive energy prices up, and really the only countries that are going to benefit are countries like Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Iran, which sell oil for a living and make mm-hmm. good profits when energy prices are high.
So really, we're looking at more evidence of the deliberate sabotage of America's economy.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely, I mean, there's got Wall Street Journal articles to where they definitely know that this climate change package is going to hurt the global energy crisis. And so that even comes down to, it's like, I don't know if Joe Biden sincerely believes in climate change or not, but even if he does, it's kind of this point. It's like, well, you know that you're going to create a global energy crisis and fuel civil wars, regular wars, and revolutions around the world because you're worried that the temperature is going to go up another degree and over the course of the next decade. And so, yeah, you just simple cost benefit analysis there. It's like, he knows this is going to cause huge problems and a great loss of life, most likely, in countries around the world, and that you're doing it. You're doing it anyway. And it, so you start looking into it. It is just really a big way for the government to increase its control. It's basically shutting down the private oil companies, nationalizing this big green industry, and have the government more control over the economy. So an article put in the show notes is from our editor-in-chief what the Paris climate change agreements were really about. Those are probably getting ready to be superseded by the Glasgow climate change agreement. But it now would be a great time to go back and found out what they did at the last climate change summit as we get ready to go into the next one.
Yeah, there are a lot of people who are watching what the Biden administration is doing, and they can see the deliberate intent behind this. What they can't see, and what you really is undiscernible if you don't see the spiritual dimension to this, is just how much there is behind this. Revealed in the Bible. Our editor-in-chief has talked a lot about this. He talks about it in that Paris Climate Agreement article that you spotlighted that we'll put in the show notes. It really is a very crucial dimension to understanding what is really going on here. We thank you very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, is Israel about to start a war with Iran? We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Iran is on the cusp of building its own nuclear weapons, and this puts enormous pressure on Israel to do something to protect itself, even start a war. Will it happen? To talk about this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
There's been a lot of stories over the past 2 weeks talking about how close Israel is to a preemptive strike on Iran before they get their nuclear program too far advanced that they will not be able to stop Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon via its homegrown processes that it's been working on for decades. And we know now that Israel has $1.5 billion that's been dedicated for this potential military strike. The Air Force is currently, apparently, at least what's been leaked or said to news sources, that they're planning such a strike that would involve as much quite a lot of military hardware to involve different strikes at simultaneous times to try and knock out the capability that Iran has. And this also comes at a time when you have the head of the IAEA, the international watchdog that's charged for overseeing Iran's nuclear program, that it adheres to several rules, that it doesn't develop too much of the enriched uranium to use for a nuclear weapon. Of course, this organization doesn't do anything about it, but at least they're meant to be there to show the world what Iran is up to. However, just a week ago, the head of the IAEA, Rafael Grossi, he warned that the measures taken to monitor Iran's nuclear program were no longer intact, meaning that they do not have eyes, ears on the ground in Iran to see what's going on. They do not know how far Iran is marching towards a nuclear weapon. And then you had another piece just from last week on October 19th from the Wall Street Journal, which talks about which really gave the logic behind Iran's moves to a nuclear weapon, saying this, quote, Khamenei, the head of Iran, and his henchmen haven't spent billions and endured a tidal wave of sanctions and social unrest only to get close to a nuclear weapon. They will build the bomb as soon as they can and justify it afterwards. And so you've had a lot of attention from international media, from even the UN, and from Israel saying that Iran is there. And words, as Naftali Bennett said, the Prime Minister of Israel, to the UN last week, words, or a week and a half ago, words are not going to stop the centrifuges from spinning. And so Israel is basically telling the world, this is coming. We're the number one target of Iran. If they get nuclear weapons, it's an existential crisis for our country. And so we're preparing to attack.
Israel's definitely in a tough spot. Do you think that they will do anything about it?
I think they've got the necessity to act and at least delay, if they can, Iran's nuclear program. But you also have the pressure of the United States that doesn't want Israel to act in this fashion. Many people believe, and commentators believe, that Israel can only delay for a certain amount of time, and perhaps Israel has even lost that capability already, since you've got massive warehouses and centrifuge halls that are underneath mountains in Iran. And so Israel would have to figure out a different way to get in there and disrupt that. Anything less than regime change in Iran, and I don't know if Israel can do that, is going to get in the way of Iran getting a nuclear weapon. And it is incredibly dangerous to think about this. Our world has grown used to the use of the existence of nuclear weapons without them being used, but we have not seen a fanatical regime led by a fanatical leader whose major doctrine isn't just being a terrorist state or exporting terrorism. They do that, but their major doctrine and their major motivation is bringing about the return of their messiah figure, and that invokes nuclear war. That invokes chaos and world war. All they need to do is push the world towards that point, and they believe that their messiah will return. Just one quote. This is from Joel Rosenberg, a former aide to Benjamin Netanyahu, in his book. He said this about Iran's leadership. They believe that the way to bring about the return of the Mahdi is to methodically acquire weapons of mass destruction and then launch the war that will bring about the consummation of the end of days. End quote. And that's exactly what the Bible says about Iran's end time strategy, a king of the south that pushes the world towards war. So people need to really pay attention to Iran's nuclear program.
We have an article on our website, Iran is Crossing the Nuclear Rubicon, about this subject. We also have a booklet by Gerald Fleury, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door, that speaks of the biblical prophecies of the dangers of nuclear warfare. Thank you very much for that, Brent. Israel's vulnerability, particularly given America's unfaithfulness, really has it looking to other allies for support. And one crucial nation it's building closer ties with is Germany. It's a move that has significant prophetic importance. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, it does. We saw the Blue Flag 2021 aerial exercises beginning on October 17th. They lasted until yesterday. And these are the biggest, the most advanced aerial exercises that have ever been held in Israel. I think this is the second exercises that Germany has been involved in. And as usual, whenever Germany is involved, there are always some very poignant symbols. So there are a total of 70 aircraft involved in all these drills, 100 different soldiers. Germany contributed 6 Eurofighters and about 160 soldiers. I thought this was interesting, where the German military's website, their headline for the event was, "The Air Force Travels to the Promised Land." And you get the theme from all of this, that both sides, both Israel and Germany, put a lot of significance into these exercises as a symbol of the partnership. This is more than just a normal standard military exercise. The one Israeli major general, he said, "The winds of history are strongly felt throughout Israel's capital," as German and Israeli jets flew over side by side. The German military's news website, they wrote, the special foiled Eurofighters represents the special friendly relationship between Germany and Israel. They had, so I should have mentioned, they had some specially painted Eurofighters over there with the German flag and the European flag there together.
Anytime we see this kind of cooperation between Israel and Germany, it kind of rings our alarm bells, not only because of the history, but because of the prophecy.
That's right. I mean, these two countries do have very close military relations. There's been just November last year, there was a new corvette delivered to Israel. Israel relies upon Germany's submarines. In fact, Israel relies upon Germany's submarines probably for their nuclear weapons, so some of their most secure military. So this exercise was symbolic, but it was symbolic of a very real real substance, that Germany that Israel trusts Germany militarily, and that these two have a close relationship. And I think a great place to learn more, just as I start to get into the prophecy, Brent had an article, I'll plug one of his this time, just a couple of weeks ago, Germany failed to heed Merkel's 2008 Knesset speech. But that really does give a great overview of the relationship between these two countries and the close ties between these two countries. But then it also gives a really good introduction to some of the what the Bible prophesies, you know, that this is completely or mostly uncontroversial now. But it's a big deal for Israel to trust Germany. You know, I don't need to explain the history, I don't think, there to anybody. And it was something, as he talks about in that article, that Israel was initially nervous about. And that is less so the case now. But the Bible really cautions, well, more than cautions, sounds a trumpet blast of warning to Israel about this relationship. Not just that Germany can't trust Israel, but it prophesies this exact relationship where Israel would put their trust completely into Germany, and then that trust would be betrayed. And so we see Israel trusting completely in Germany, and the Bible really warns, no, God's saying, look, you don't trust in the military, don't trust in Germany, trust in me. Get your relationship with me right, and I will protect you. That's what God wants. That's what God will do for any of us individually. And instead, humanly, we look for all of these different alternatives. It's no different on the national scene. And this is prophesied to be an absolute disaster for Israel. But, you know, like I said, that option is there. Israel can repent and trust in God, and that's something that any of us can do individually.
Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. We will link to Brent's article about Germany failing to heed Merkel's Knesset speech in the show notes, as well as an article about this specific news item, German Air Force flies over promised land. We appreciate you bringing that to us, Richard. China's recent tests of a hypersonic missile represents a huge step forward in that nation's military progress. One senior U.S. general says that's only part of an extremely concerning picture regarding China's war-making capability. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, we spoke on the show last week about just the major milestone that those hypersonic missile tests represented for China. And as you said, this week, the second most senior U.S. general put those tests alongside some of the Chinese military's other recent advancements and just China's rise in general. And he said that the overall picture shows that the capabilities China's military is developing are nothing short of stunning. So this was General John Hyten, the outgoing vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was speaking at a Defense Writers Group roundtable, and I'll just read through some of his assessments here. He said, calling China a pacing threat is a useful term because the pace at which China is moving is stunning. The pace they're moving and the trajectory they're on will surpass Russia and the U.S. if we don't do something to change it. It will happen. So I think we have to do something. End quote. So Hyten is retiring next month, and these were some of his parting comments. A lot of this was intended as advice for his successor, whoever that might be. But it shows that whatever notions many in America may be clinging to about the superiority of America's military power, the Chinese are catching up at almost hypersonic speeds, and there's not much time before that gap will be closed.
Now, he, in his comments, not only did he talk about China's capability, but he contrasted that with some of the problems that hinder the United States from being as progressive in its military capabilities as it could be.
That's right. Yes, that was another big theme from General Hyten's remarks. He's very worried about red tape in the U.S. military, just about the U.S. being too hampered by bureaucracy to be able to make the kinds of course corrections that are needed. At one point in his remarks, he said, "Although the U.S. is making marginal progress, the Department of Defense is still unbelievably bureaucratic and slow. We can go fast if we want to, but the bureaucracy we put in place is just brutal." End quote. So, you know, Hyten's retiring in a few weeks, as I mentioned, and on his way out, he's really just trying to sound the alarm on America's lumbering bureaucracy and how that's preventing us from being able to respond to, well, what he called this stunning pace of China's growing military capabilities. So it's somewhat reassuring to hear someone in his position sounding the alarm the way he is. But, you know, given the general state of affairs and U.S. leadership right now, I think it's hard to see how much will really be done about this warning.
So how do you view his comments and what we see happening in China from a prophetic perspective?
Well, it's I think one of the most interesting aspects of this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy is sort of what we discussed in the first half, and that is how Europe will be responding to this. You know, it's hard to envision U.S. leadership making the kinds of changes that Hyten's recommending, but I think that we can expect Europe to be watching China more and more closely and taking the threat more and more seriously. In the first half, we spoke about Russia's increasing military power and how that's one of the big factors making the Europeans want to politically and militarily unite. And we spoke about how that's becoming an even higher priority in the wake of that, you know, that withdrawal from Afghanistan, since that showed Europe that they need to be ready to face rivals on their own. And the same thing's happening with China and Europe. Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry tied a lot of this together in a recent episode of his Key of David program. He mentioned a verse in Daniel 11, which talks about a time in the near future when Europe, or the Holy Roman Empire, will be troubled by tidings out of the east and the north. And then Mr. Flurry said, quote, "Tidings out of the east, Russia, China, and their allies. The Holy Roman Empire that becomes the superpower is going to be disturbed and worried about what's happening in Russia and China and how they're just about to really decimate all of Europe." End quote. So, you know, from that prophecy, we know that in the future, Europe will be disturbed by Russia and China, and we know that that's a big factor in Europe's military campaigns. And we don't need to connect too many dots right now, I think, to see that even now, China's military rise, this rise that's being called stunning, is arresting Europe's attention. And the prophecies tell us to expect Europe to unite and to become a military juggernaut. And it's easy to see how China's rise right now is already factoring into Europe's transformation.
All right. Well, we thank you for bringing that to us. We will link to that show, The Key of David, The Missing Dimension in Afghanistan, in the show notes. COVID has transformed our world in one truly stunning way that many people are unaware of. To learn about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, for some Americans, the pandemic is starting to end. Kids are going back to school. A lot of employees are going back to work. Most of the restaurants, at least around here, are reopening. Even some of the travel bans are ending. But for small businesses, things are really worse than ever in a lot of ways. The energy crisis we talked about in the first half, the inflation, and the other supply chain shortages are just really putting the pressure on the little mom and pop shops around the nation. And a lot of them are going under. I think there's actually been about 200,000 small businesses that have already closed during the pandemic, and there'll probably be more this coming year, given the supply chain shortages and other things. So that's about a 30% drop in the number of small businesses in America. Well, at the same time, all these businesses are closing, but the people who used to did business there still need to do business someplace. And so they're turning towards the big companies, the companies that had the financial reserves before the pandemic, saved up for a hard time, that are actually even increasing their profits from all the new business they're getting from leveling the competition. Actually, Carol Roth is a pretty prominent small business advisor in America who's just authored a book that's really well documented. It's entitled The War on Small Business, How the Government Used the Pandemic to Crush the Backbone of America. And she makes the case that a lot of these government-imposed lockdowns were specifically engineered to put small businesses out of business. And then a lot of the government-imposed stimulus packages have actually, that money has worked their way into the hands of the big businesses. And so the big businesses have really profited while the small businesses have gone under. And so she's she even expresses it that said the federal government, with the help of the Federal Reserve, is overseeing the largest transfer of wealth in human history from Main Street to Wall Street. And so, like I said, really just a very fundamental transformation of America's economy. It was a country founded on the principle of decentralization, and now everything's becoming centralized as the government takes more power from the states, and the big businesses take more money and business away from the small businesses. It's actually an interesting point that the late Herbert W. Armstrong, he was talking about this back in 1944, where he gave a Bible study to the Businessman's Bible Class of San Antonio, where he made that exact point. He said this country was founded on the basis of decentralization. But today there's a rapid shift towards centralization in all fields, not only in business, but in government. And then he even quotes a prophecy in James 5, verses 1 through 5, where God's condemning a lot of these rich businessmen who are using the government to put phony crises like COVID to destroy small business owners. He says, "Come now, you rich men, weep and shriek over your impending miseries. You have stored up treasures in the last days. See the wages you have defrauded the workmen who mowed your fields." And then he adds, "or really worked your factories." That's a prophecy about these big businessmen oftentimes working with the government to like defraud people of their wages. And that's something he's talking about back in 1944, but it's really seems like the best example of that almost anyone could think of is this COVID pandemic, where they used a bad flu season to lay 40 million Americans off of their jobs, push 8 million Americans into poverty, shut down 30% of the small businesses, while at the same time, like Google and Walmart and Pfizer are just making money hand over fist.
Quite an amazing picture of what's happening, this wealth transfer that you're talking about here, and how this is very much in keeping with that communist takeover of the United States. The idea that essentially these huge companies, I noticed that in the article that you wrote about this, we linked to that Carol Roth book, The War on Small Business. And if you click on the link, it takes you to Amazon. these companies that are very closely allied with the government in many ways, and trillions of dollars that have basically migrated from these small business owners, from the middle class in America, into the hands of these companies that are in bed with the government in many ways. And that kind of state ownership over the national economy and over commerce, that's right out of the communist playbook.
Right, absolutely. Because it's, yeah, you start looking at that, and I mean, Google was funded with grants from the CIA. Google was founded with grants from the CIA. Pfizer has former employees on all the FDA boards that are approving, determining whether the vaccine of their previous employer is safe for children or not. And so you're definitely seeing this, like, okay, these big companies are making millions of dollars because they've got lobbyists that are cutting deals with the government, like, oh no, everyone needs to be vaccinated, and they need to like buy vaccines from the company I represent. Mm-hmm. And so it's a bit of a conflict of interest there, and it's
and that's an understatement,
right? It's a bit of a conflict of interest, but it's definitely some people would maybe have a hard time to see how that's communist, because it's like these big corporations oppressing the poor. But it's that's really, as much as the communists talked about the poor, what it ended up being is you have a central planning committee, and it doesn't really matter much whether the central planning committee comes from a corporation or from a Soviet workers' council. Mm-hmm. It's still a group of a few dozen people that are making decisions for the entire nation, end up impoverishing millions so they can become rich. So communist, corporatist, fascist, if it's not espousing freedom, it all ends up in the same place. Mm.
Well, Andrew's written an article about this. Big companies are starting to swallow the world. We will link to that in the show notes for today's program. Quite a fascinating story. And I think those prophecies that he pointed to, actually that Herbert W. Armstrong pointed to, really do bring on fresh life when you read them in the context of what's happening now. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of William Wordsworth: "The best portion of a good man's life is his little, nameless, unencumbered acts of kindness and of love." Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.